Hello and welcome to the Walt Weekly Podcast. My name is Walter Latham and I'm your host along with your co-host Michelle Sweeney McCombs. Today we have a very special guest, and matter of fact, he's a member of our Friday Live podcast that we do every Friday at 6 p.m. He's a member of the panel, and he's one of the people that we turn to for their viewpoint on major issues concerning our community. Also, this gentleman is a Marine combat veteran, and he spent 10 years serving our country. And we would like to thank him for his services. And let me let you know, his name is Sergeant Ernest J. Robinson. And we want to thank him for his service to our country. Yeah. Thank you, Ernest.
Yeah. Thank you, Ernest.
Okay. Yeah, well, welcome to your one-on-one, Ernest. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for joining us, Ernest. And thank you for the work that you do.
Yes. I'm humbled and honored. Definitely. Honored. Thank you.
We would like to get an understanding of your worldview, Ernest. Mm-hmm. But then let's first talk about, you know, where you grew up. And let's go there first, because I want to determine, you know, what shape, you know, the way you see things.
It's a great question. So my, you know, who I am today is I'm a product of a grandfather who was an immigrant from the Caribbean. Who married my grandmother, who was from the South, Bertie County, which is way out in the middle of nowhere for those who are trying to figure out what Bertie County is. Those that may know some of the cities, Windsor, Williamston, in that area of North Carolina. They mm-hmm. migrated to New York, to the Bronx, New York, where my mother was born and raised. And married my father, who was from Philadelphia. And I put that in the context because, again, when you're talking about a worldview, there are so many different things that kind of tie us all together. So I was born in New Orleans, Louisiana, lived there for a few years, moved to Jacksonville, North Carolina, based upon my father moving. My biological parents divorced. My mother remarried another Marine. And so we wound up moving to Virginia. I moved down to Beaufort, South Carolina. That's all the Low Country. For those who are from that area.
Yeah.
From Beaufort, Hilton Head, Savannah, Georgia area.
Right.
And then moved back to Virginia, where then I joined the Marine Corps at the age of 17. And left from there to go to got stationed back in North Carolina again, then to Okinawa, Japan, to California. 9/11 took place while I was in Japan. Went from there to came back, went to Iraq at the age of 20. Wow. And then, so I fought in the war in 2003. That's almost 20 years ago itself now, 18 years ago now. Got stationed back in South Carolina, lived there for a little while, then moved, stationed back in Virginia, where I ended my military service. So I have experienced, being overseas with different cultures. The time that I spent in Kuwait, time I spent in Iraq, when I flew back through Germany. On the way over there, we sailed across the Atlantic. I saw the coast of Morocco. We traveled through the Atlantic, the Mediterranean Sea, through the going past Egypt, around Oman, into the Indian Ocean, and then into Kuwait. Circumstances were a little different,
Right.
Yeah. Okay, great.
Yeah, but no, but you, yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's, yeah, yeah. So, yeah, so that's kind of where I was just trying to, I was mentioning those things, not necessarily to talk about them in detail. I mean, obviously we can talk about them at any point in time, but it was just kind of give context to when you ask about a worldview, as far as understanding my worldview, that's kind of where it comes from, is having an appreciation for different cultures. You know what I'm saying? So again, growing up in the South, spending my summers in New York, in the Bronx, being able to experience different music. So, you know, and I grew up in a time, you know, I was born in the 80s. So I was growing in a time where hip hop was taking off and things were happening. Right. And I remember Fat Joe when he came out. I remember Peter Guns when he was actually a street performer. I remember Corey Guns when he was just 4 or 5 years old. Him and Lord Tariq's son was rapping for the very first time on Vice. But now I saw the South movement. I saw, you know, clothes, and right. I was wearing Parasuco, and you know, so it's just And then when I got into the military, I traveled and I met people who had never met black people before. I met black people who had never met white people. I met grown men who didn't know how to tie a tie, who didn't know how to clean, who didn't know how to do certain things. And so, and then traveling to all the cultures, you know, how we were respected in some areas of Japan, or I was specifically stationed in Okinawa. But then, like, some of the disturbances that were happening there. And then, so it just gave me at a very young age, a very wide view that the world is much bigger than sometimes we think that it is. Yeah, go ahead.
So you had a chance to see that, to see the world different from being on the U.S. soil. So you had a chance to see a difference.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because the one thing I noticed is that, you know, when I was traveling, is that you miss America. You don't miss it until it's not there. That's one thing I can say about this country. You know, you don't miss it until it's not there. You know, when you cut the lights on, when you hit the switch to cut the lights on here, the lights go on. If you pay your bill, by the way, now don't get me wrong. But in certain countries, you can go without lights for days. You know, so.
Right.
Just by going to other countries, like you said, you get a different, it gives you what's the word I'm looking for?
A deeper,
it gives you a different, yeah, different, exactly. You know, it could be either pro or con, depending on who you are. Yeah. Okay.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, even that, just, you know, women's rights is a huge difference, you know, when you're talking about being in the Middle East.
Right.
But just like you said, for lights, water, food. I mean, we went days without a shower. I mean, we washed up in different ways, but we, you know, days without, weeks without a home, you know, with actually cooked food. We ate a lot of MREs. And so you grow to appreciate what you do have, while you have it. And so it's one of those things for me, like, you know, now I just appreciate people, appreciate life a lot different. I think that I was able to gain that appreciation early on.
Okay, I understand. Yeah. All right. Now, another question now. I know you travel, but let's go back a little bit more. What's your alma mater? What college did you go to?
Oh, so yeah. So actually, so during my closer towards my end of my military career, I went back to, I went to college to play college ball just so I can make it to the NFL. I did.
Ah, football player. Yeah, okay.
Oh, yeah, wow. That's interesting.
I did some pro days. I did some combines. I was actually scouted by the Eagles. And I don't have a favorite team. Whoever was going to sign me was going to be my favorite team. So go.
I was going to ask.
Good try.
Let me guess. Tight end. That was your position. Oh, okay.
Running back.
Oh, man.
I actually went as a linebacker, but then switched over to running back because I also ran.
Yeah, I was thinking running back. I went to
Virginia Union University, which is a historically black college university in Richmond, Virginia. I majored in criminal justice, minored in psychology. I was actually a dual major. I was only supposed to major in both, but my daughter was born, in 2009. And so it didn't make sense for me to continue on with my schooling when I needed to kind of go ahead and go to work and get things moving. Well, actually, while I was in school, I like to tell this, for everybody else who may experience that in their lives, right? It's never too late to go back to school. So I was 24. I was 24 years old, but I got onto the football team, made a football team. I got involved in student government. I got involved in civic engagement. During that time, Genesis 6 was taking place. And so I organized our students to go to the Fall March on Justice in Washington, D.C. Got involved in judicial affairs, the NAACP, and a host of other clubs and things while I was still in school, as well as going to and participating in the military at the same time, and working a full time job, working as a armed security officer.
Proud of you.
Wore a lot of hats.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
But that's what you have to do. Hat. I mean, that's it. That's what you have to do. Yeah, for sure. I mean, you're a millennial.
Right.
That's what millennials got to do. Matter of fact, I can give you quickly. When I finished my bachelor's, and I finished my bachelor's in 93, 92. All right. I got my bachelor's degree. And I was already in my 40s. So I decided that, I'm going to go to law school. So I took the LSAT. And I was accepted at Brooklyn Law and Touro Law, okay? And I was working with Michelle at the time. I think I transferred by that time, Michelle. Right. This is like 95. Mm-hmm. I think that I went to a different department. We weren't working together at that time. But same company, or you left, whatever.
Yeah, I left first.
So the company that I worked for, said that what I really wanted to do was leave every day at 5, at like 5 o'clock, so I can get to class, because classes were from like 6:30 to 10:30, four nights a week, and then you did a lot of your other work on the weekend. But they said no. They said, we can't set an example. So I understand. So I switched and I went and for my MBA, which I obtained, because I couldn't go to law school because the job said no. But here's the joke. My daughter told me, said, "Dad, if you go to law school, then you got to go to the DA office, and you'll be like Matlock by the time you get out." that was the point.
Wow.
I was trying to get to. My daughter even said it. So it's never too late, guys. It's never
too late. No, it's never too late.
Yeah, even if you be like Matlock. That's what I wanted to add. All right,
that's interesting, because that's what I just recently reconsidered going to law school, and I got a couple of years before I hit 40, but I have reconsidered doing that myself.
Yeah,
so, you're young enough to do it.
I'll pick up where you left off.
Yeah, please do that.
Yeah, that's great.
I mean, that's very commendable, and you keep going, Ernest. You definitely can make your mark. All right. Well, let me give you just one little tip when you do your personal statement. All right. Once you accept it, you do your personal statement there, along with your applications, rather. And mine was, I was the first in my family, and we were poor, so I'll be the first to go to law school, and that way I can help my family. All right. a friend of mine who was my law school, I took business law under him, told me, you can't put that down. You got to say that you want to do good and pro bono, but never talk about how much money you want to make. So that's the tip I want to give you, Ernest.
Oh, right. Yeah. Wow. I appreciate it.
Yeah, because most people, I want to sue, go ahead. I'm sorry. I defer.
For me, it would never have been that. I wanted to go to law school and get my PhD simultaneously. And I wanted to concentrate on constitutional law in my dissertation so that I can talk about the negative effects of the Constitution as it has affected the African-American community. And interestingly enough, during this particular week, there is a heavy emphasis on the bearings of the Constitution and what's allowed and what's not allowed and the interpretation of it. And so I think that really taking a look at it and doing a deep dive and interpreting that, I think will play into the questions of reparations and responsibility and accountability and different things that kind of affect our communities and ways of being able to kind of reassess and readjust those things.
Nice. All right. Now, what do you think? Since you mentioned reparations, what do you think about reparations? You think that we should be paid reparations, given reparations?
I believe so. I believe that the term itself, reparations, is sometimes misunderstood. That a lot of people just believe that it is just it can just be monetary, and I think that there's other ways of kind of alleviating or being able to repay or repair the damage that was done. And so I think there are many ways that we could do it. I do believe that it's something that should be done. I think it should be strategic and very intellectual in how we approach it. But yes, in short, I do believe it should be done. But I think it will take a lot of smarter heads to kind of get together and figure out what's appropriate. What's fair? What's just? Because it's just not, it should not just be a blanket. Hey, let's just give everybody
send a check out. Everybody a check.
Right.
Yeah.
Nah.
Yeah. But at the same time, I don't believe it shouldn't be restricted because your family has done well, right? So at the same time, just because you happen to have pulled yourself by the bootstraps and you're doing well, that you should be eliminated from it, and it should only go to those who are the poorest of the poor. And I don't think that's fair or just either, because I think that in itself can be another topic that we can talk about on the Walt Week.
All right. Okay. There's some stuff out there. You may want to go back to the archives, but I did one on reparations.
He did.
I'm just saying an additional one. I got
you. But we need to do a new one. Yeah, I just want to.
Yeah, with a panel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I want Joe Biden to settle in before we start, getting with that. Yeah, right. So, but anyway, when you left the military, and how was transition to back to your civilian life? Was that just a smooth transition, or?
For me, I grew up in the military family. Right. And so my grandfather served, my father served, my stepdad served, cousins, uncles, I served. So to me, it was, I guess it was smooth in a sense. There were some things that I really didn't know. I'll say that our transition period now for service members getting out is a lot better than it was when I initially had gotten out. So you have to understand, I left active duty in 2005, but then went back into the Selective Marine Reserves, which is how I got the 10 years of service.
So I
did have a separation in active duty, but then went to the reserves. So So there was a little bit of so how I wound up at Virginia Union was because I didn't know anything about going to college. Like I went into the Marine Corps at the age of 17. Like I swore in 2 days after my 17th birthday.
Wow.
So I knew nothing about college. I knew nothing about, you know, my first job was McDonald's, you know, prior to going to the Marine Corps. My job, my first real job that I paid taxes on was working at McDonald's.
Wow. I would have gone to the Marine Corps too. Yeah.
Oh, brother, no. I burnt myself on the grill one day, and I was like, I will never do this job ever again. It was a little difficult in preparation for, you know, writing my resume. I had never really interviewed for a job. You know, saying besides, you know, the job that I had at McDonald's, which was, you know, you're a strapping young man, you're at high school, you got all your other high school buddies that work here. Are you available on nights and weekends? You're hired. So I wasn't really, you know, prepared for a lot of things. But I believe that the motto of overcome, adapt, and improvise that I learned while being in the military, specifically in the Marine Corps, I think did prepare me, help me in my transition. I won't say prepare me, but I think it helped me in those tough situations and in figuring things out and being able to go at it with a certain level of confidence. In preparation for life. Yeah.
Because I did want to ask you about any. Could you speak to any memorable experiences, some of the things that stood out when you were on active duty in the Marine Corps as a sergeant, combat sergeant? I wanted to ask you that.
In what sense? I mean, there's...
You know,
there's
what things stood out besides the travel and seeing different cultures? You know, some major memorable events. It could be a couple of things that, you know, really, you know, were like, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, as far as, you know, things that were most memorable for me, you know, the first thing was, you know, I actually had lived, again, I lived in Beaufort before. So Parris Island is the boot camp where everyone, all Marines go to on the East Coast.
Right.
But I had lived there. And my prom was actually on Parris Island. And a couple months later, then I'm there. So that in some was just,
wow.
Because while we're on the bus and we're getting off, I'm like, yo, my prom was right over here. I went to the high school right over here. And that, so that part was different. But one thing that stuck out to most of me was when I became the honor graduate. I was one of, I think there were three or four of us that were 17 years of age, and we were a couple months apart from one another. The oldest person in my platoon was 29 years old, and then there was one recruit who was who had served 7 years in the Navy, and in one particular day. Like this is, we're forming day like three. We haven't gotten to training day one yet. So we're like on forming day two or three, and they picked leaders. And he was the guide. So he was the main leader of the platoon, and there was four squad leaders. And I was one of the squad leaders. I raised my hand to be one of the leaders.
Okay.
And then on day three, on forming day three, so again, mind you, we're not even on training day one yet. He quit. He wow. says, I don't want to be the guy. I don't want to be the guy. I don't want to be the leader. I just want to concentrate on being a regular recruit. And so my senior drill instructor at the time had asked, well, who wants to be the guide? And I raised my hand. And from that day all the way through boot camp, I remained as a leader and graduated as the honor graduate. And so that's one thing that had kind of stuck out.
That's great. You were destined to be a leader.
One prior to that, my stepdad, my dad had told me that I didn't have the heart to become a Marine.
And so,
so you had the glove was thrown down.
I had every day was being able to prove that. Another thing,
Marine though, you know, that isn't that like the toughest military? Like it's very hard to be a Marine.
We're the few and the proud for a reason. We do have the toughest boot camp. Mm-hmm. It's the longest boot camp that there is. You go through Marine Corps boot camp, and once you serve in the Marine Corps, within the first 3 years, if you decide to switch go to any other branch of service, you don't have to go through their boot camp. Branch of service that leaves their service, mm-hmm. any other branch outside of the Marine Corps, they have to go through Marine Corps, which is why there was one had served 7 years in the Navy, another one had served like 4 or 5 years in Special Forces in the Army, and he still had to go through boot camp, Marine Corps boot camp, before becoming a Marine. So it is one of the hardest and toughest, and that's for male and female.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have a lot of women that are down there and are just as tough as nails, that go through a very rigorous training. So it's one of the things that kind of stuck out. I mean, obviously 9/11 when I was in Okinawa, I was 20 years old when I was in Iraq, when I fought in combat. But it's one of those things too, that kind of, and again, goes back to the question that Walt had asked initially about my understanding of the worldview. It's one of those things where I don't place a lot of emphasis on people who are young and they don't know any better. Or when people are 18 and 19 years old, refer to them as their children or, you know, I mean, granted, they're somebody's child. We're all somebody's child.
Yeah.
But the notion that they can't use critical thinking or be in a situation and make a tough decision, I don't buy into that. And so at every moment that I hear that, I always tend to try. I do my best to tactfully and respectfully correct that, because young people are more powerful than we oftentimes give them credit for. Or allow for them to be.
Okay, so now explain that. I didn't understand that. So are you saying that the conclusions or beliefs of young people should be, how would you say, should we ignore it, are they wise and we should listen to what they're saying?
No. I think anyone should be corrected if they are, you know, if something is wrong. But I think like we take like people who like some young people who may be doing the wrong thing or like, oh, they're just being young. You know, they're just being young folks. That's what young people do. And no, that's not what young people do, because they're still adults. And at the age of, and again, I went in Marine Corps at 17. I carried a rifle. At the age of 17, I graduated boot camp. I was a United States Marine at 17. I didn't turn 18 until I was in combat training in another
program. Wow.
Right? So if I'm responsible enough to be able to carry a rifle with weapons, shoot live, you know, rounds and this, you know, I can go to combat at the age of 20.
Mm-hmm.
Be in charge, lead other Marines on a convoy to go from one point of a country that none of us have been in to another part of a country that none of us have been in order to be able to retrieve, you know, materials or support or mail or whatever it is, and have the responsibility of bringing it back, then I'm more than certain that young people can function correctly without breaking the laws. Or doing whatever. So sometimes I think we should be, you know, I think everything should just be, I guess, graded. Maybe a scale in some sense of how we view things. But I don't think the excuse of them just being young or people just being old or whatever is an excuse for ill behaviors.
Okay, I agree with that. I agree with that. Yeah. I think that what I was trying to get at is that, I mean, I can take, for example, my youngest son. Okay, mm-hmm. He's around your age now. You know, y'all guys are about the same age. Anyway, I remember maybe when he was 20, 21. You know, he was strong believer, you know, into politics and this and that. And mm-hmm. I had some positions that I took, and he said, I don't believe that, you know. And I can tell you, he called me a racist, believe it or not. So I told him, I said, look, I tell you what, why don't you come back and then we can discuss these political matters 10 years from now. Come back to me 10 years from now. Okay. I was very proud that he was very independent in his thinking. Don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, his positions, he supported his positions, but yet and still it was not tempered with experience. Mm-hmm. All right. He hadn't been there, done that. All right. So I told him, come back, talk to me 10 years from now. And believe it or not, he comes back and he said, Dad, what do you think about this? You know, I can imagine what you went through. All right. So that's the way I see the belief system of a lot of young people is that they haven't experienced certain things. You know, they draw conclusions from, you know, their contemporaries who don't know anything either. You know, they haven't experienced it. So life is what you really, really learn from of you know, being exposed to certain things. And I think that's where I was leading up to.
Well, I think to your point, and again, it goes back to I gave you praise for how you framed your questions, right? So it goes back to that. So when I grew up in an age or in a time, and granted, I'm a millennial, on the tail end of it, but, you know, I am. But I always sat down to listen to my elders, right? Mm-hmm. I actively listened. Because one thing that I know now for sure is that you can be an old fool and you can be a new
fool. That's right.
Age does not always come with wisdom.
Absolutely. Right?
And so sometimes we give too much deference to those who are older because they're older. And we assume that they've had experience, right? Mm-hmm. But we haven't met, because some people don't actively listen, we haven't measured the quality of that experience. But then oftentimes we're too dismissive to those who may be younger, who may have a quality of experience. So there are some things that we can definitely learn. And so I think that's where, again, the old fool and the new fool kind of, you know, bump heads, is because neither one are listening to one another.
Exactly.
Man, you know, to figure out, you know, so yeah, so I think that I'm glad it worked out for you and your son. But that's what I mean is that I had taken the time when I grew up to be able to listen to those who are older than me, those who are younger than me, and if you can be 8 years old, I'll listen, you know, hear you out, you know, because there may be something that you're saying, you may not be saying it all the way, but because I am experienced, I can maybe put the two of them together, right?
Right.
And there may be something that someone's saying that's older than me that it don't really sound, but maybe this is what they meant. Okay. And we can put it together, but I think we just all need to actively listen to one another. And then also correct one another too. And I think that's one of the good things about, you know, what you did was, you know, hey, maybe we don't need to discuss this out, because what good does it mean to prove that I'm right?
Right.
Right. So there's a saying that you can give up your right for someone else's wrong. So I don't have to prove that I'm right to you. I'll give up the fight of proving that I'm right. Come back and let's have a discussion, and let's work the whole situation out. And I think that if we did more of that in in our society, in our communities, that we would, you know, that we may be able to get a lot further.
Right. Well, I have a quick question. It's not on the other questions, sure. But, you know, growing up as a kid, you know, I know you had military background with your grandfather, your father, your stepdad, but was that something that you thought about doing? Like, you never had dreams of being anything else other than going straight into the military, or the job at McDonald's is what flipped you to go to the military?
No.
You know what I mean? Like, did you, you know, most kids have dreams to be, you know, they're not thinking about the military. They're thinking about having other dreams and aspirations. You know, that's pretty young, you know, to go into the military.
So I'm going to tell you what happened. So to answer your question in short, no, I didn't have anything. That Marine Corps was what I wanted to do.
Okay.
And I came up, and I was convicted at the age of 13.
Wow.
Yes, I grew up with it all my life. I've been to the parades, saw the Marines, you know, in the Marine Corps band, the sound and drill team. I was on the bases. My mother used to work at the club, the NCO club on base, and we used to go to the, you know, so yeah.
It's part of your life. Okay.
It was part of my life. So. But then, as I said before, my mom tried to get me to go to the Air Force. She was like, baby, the Marines are tough, you know. And then my stepdad had said, well, you ain't got the heart for it. So then I was like, nope, this is what I'm doing. Get to high school. Now I get to 13 years old. I get to high school. Now I'm 15 and I'm starting to run track. I'm playing football, and I'm like, my coach starts to talk to me about a track scholarship. Mm-hmm. And now I'm 16 years old, and I'm like, hey, mom, I want to go to college. She was like, no, you going to the Marine Corps, like you said.
Wow.
4 years ago. To me, it was no longer even an option. I took it off the table for myself. I mean, respectfully, they would have saved for me to go to school. You know, they would have helped me to be able to take on that responsibility of going. And so when I took it off the table, that's what happened.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
Wow. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So now, for the last 5 years, and we're gonna shift gears here, all right? And we're going to move on to the political spectrum. All right, for the last 5 years, notwithstanding 2020, all right, I mean, last year is, you know, what do you think of racial relations in this country that you, you know, serve?
Oh, that's a kind of a loaded question. Almost. Not,
well, I didn't mean for it to be loaded.
I said almost. No. I got you, brother. I think that the racial relations are, I think they're good. And the reason I say they're good, I mean, they're bad, but it's good because we're able to see everybody now. I think there's a lot of, I mean, there was a whole lot of people over the past, you know, maybe 10, 15 years, it's been very, very covert about their level of hatred or racism and or ignorance. And I won't blanket everyone as a racist. Some people are just completely
right. They don't know any better.
Know no better. And that's black and white people. You know, that's black and white people that are that way.
Definitely.
Right? But I think that over the past, I mean, granted, notwithstanding 2020, but I think, you know, including 2020, 2019, I think, I mean, actually, even back to 2016, really, during the election time frame, we got to, a lot of people got exposed, and a lot more people, and it's happening in more and more into the military, where people have become more boisterous about politics, which is something that is not a part of our culture. Within the military. Right. But I think that we're also at a point right now that, I mean, unfortunately, 2021 started off with an insurrection on the Capitol, and where a lot of visceral, just malicious individuals, you know, attacked. And we're at a point right now where I think that it, hopefully there can be some reconciliation of racial justice, social civic justice, and maybe at a point where this is what kind of was needed in order to rebuild.
Okay.
You know, kind of tear the whole house down in order to rebuild.
I think, I agree with you. What do you think? What do you think now from a military standpoint and from your time on the ground, because you were up close and personal? What do you think of what the new Secretary of Defense's request to stand down so that he, you know, they could take the time to do I wouldn't say interrogate, but question the members of the military about how they stand on these white supremacist issues and stuff like that. You think that was?
Well, do I think it was what, good?
Yeah.
I think it was awesome. I have been waiting for our joint chiefs from all services. So from the rear admirals in the Navy to the four stars in the Marine Corps, the Air Force and the Marine Corps and the rear admirals in the Coast Guard as well, to step up and being able to denounce a lot of the whether again racist, ignorance, you know, individuals who are in the military. Because it's again, it's not a part of our culture, and it's notwithstanding to our principles. The principles in the Marine Corps are honor, courage, and commitment. And there is nothing honorable about mistreating somebody based upon the color of their skin or any other particular factor. All right. There's no courage by you putting on a uniform. Representing the military and then going in and then at night sitting there talking, you know, bad about your commander who happens to be African American or happens to be a woman or, you know, or whatever have you.
Right.
That's cowardly, you know. And it completely absolves you of the actual commitment that you made to being uphold the Constitution against enemies both foreign and domestic. So I think that I applaud what the Joint Chiefs of Staff has done. But I also want to add, though, that the Commandant of the Marine Corps had outlawed Confederate flags on all Marine bases.
Okay.
And that was something that had not been done before. So you would have individuals who are in the Marine Corps, I mean, in all any military service for that matter, would have on the back of their truck.
Oh yeah, I've seen. American flag.
And it's a Confederate flag on the other side.
Yeah,
that's an oxymoron. That is
an oxymoron.
The two of them do not go right. So it's one of those things that happened. I want to say last year, no, the year before last. I think I want to say 2018, 2019. Is when the Commandant of the Marine Corps had already started that, had made that outlawed that on military installations, on Marine Corps installations, excuse me, because he doesn't have control of everything. So I think that they're moving in the right direction and standing on the right side of history.
Okay. Right. But you know why I asked that question, and what bothers me is as they go through this process of the stand down and the questioning, trying to gauge you know who's who and their belief system is that, you know, back during the Civil War, I believe they went through something similar. I wouldn't call it a stand down, but everybody, and take General Lee and General Grant, they went to the academy, all right, together. And then when you had this situation with the Civil War, they both went two different directions. Do you see anything like that happening in the military where these guys say, look, I believe in white supremacy. I believe this is a white country, so therefore, do you see anything like that happening? Because there was some news out today that on some military, some Navy ships, there are some nooses that were hung on a number mm-hmm. of naval ships. So do you see anything like mm-hmm. that coming down the line?
I can't say for certain, no, because we just watched thousands of individuals who some were active duty, some were in the reserves, some were retired, attack the Capitol. Individuals, and there were some who supported it, but they didn't physically go. And I think part of the stand down will probably reveal a lot of that. But I don't have the feeling that it will, that we're going to go into a civil war. I don't think it's going to come to that extent right now. I do believe there's a lot of people who are going to hold on to their beliefs for whatever particular reason that they choose to do so.
Yeah, I think if Trump, if they would have overturned the election, it might have been a civil war, in my opinion. I think it was leading to it.
It was leading to it, but I don't think that it would have been. So here's the thing. I don't think that for those who wanted Joe Biden and Kamala Harris to be president and vice president of the United States, I don't mm-hmm. see that those that supported them would have come out in full regalia. I mean, or not regalia, but full tactical armor and started a war. The individuals who wanted to fight were there. Right. The individuals who wanted to have the war were there. So if they got their way, they wouldn't have fought anymore.
Mm.
Now, what I do believe would have made a serious, serious impact on whether or not if a military war would have started, would have been if any of those elected officials were seriously harmed.
Mm.
And that in itself would have started. And then that would have been, so the issue would have been that the United States military would have fought against all of those individuals who were there present at the Capitol. Right.
Right.
And that's who they would have to fight against. It would be all those. If it's 75 million, whatever that support the insurrection and all that other stuff, it would have been them having to fight against the United States military, which now for the joint chief who's sitting there saying, OK, well, if we had to go into this war against these individuals who wanted to support this insurrection, how many enemies do we have beyond the lines right now?
Right.
And so let me look at that to evaluate that, because the question that you're asking is probable. Not that it's impossible, but it's probable. And so if it came to that, what do I need to do as the joint chief over all of these services to sit there and purge our uniform ranks?
I agree. I mean, it's only risk mitigation. That's what it is. You know, you have to weigh the risk.
That's a good question, Michelle.
She's on point, no doubt.
We've been talking about his military. I think we need to move into his other gifts that he has, if you don't mind.
Oh, no. You go ahead. Sure. Go right ahead.
Yeah. You know, I want to hear a little more about your motivational speaking. Why did you choose that career path?
It's one of the things. I don't know if it's necessarily if I consider myself a motivational speaker. I like to think of myself as a teacher, an instructor, an inspirer,
educator,
an educator, right? More than anything else. And I think that hopefully I'm able to make a connection with people And I think, again, going back to that initial question about, you know, my worldview and my how I feel connected to everybody. Like, I you know, living in different areas, growing up with different people, it kind of put me in a space where I wanted to make sure I connected and connected with them to get them the resources that they needed. So one of the things that got me started was I was in college. And in 2007, I'll start briefly. So in the Marine Corps, we do small unit leadership, right? So we learn from the inception of being in boot camp about how to lead others. And so that was something that was ingrained into me very early on. Again, 17 years old, so I'm like a sponge, you know, just soaking up all these different things and these different experiences. I move along, I become a martial arts instructor, I start teaching other people how to do things, et cetera.
No way, martial arts too. That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was a combat martial arts that's designed specifically for us, but I won't mess with you, Michelle. I won't mess with you. I'll defer.
Yeah, defer on that one. You can ask Steve and Greg, yeah. They can vouch for me.
I got you. But what happened was in 2007, Genesis 6 had taken place. And for those in the audience,
right,
who may be listening, who don't remember, down in Jenin, Louisiana, there was this tree,
right,
that the black people couldn't sit down in front of, and
right,
a group of black kids had sat down, gotten in a fight. They went to jail. The white kids didn't. And so there was this big push. And so by this time I'm at Virginia Union University, again in HBCU, and at this HBCU I don't hear the conversations that I think that we should be having,
right?
And I don't see the engagement, and so I'm playing football, and so I missed the initial march in Jenin, Louisiana, because it was in August, but the Fall March on Justice was taking place in November in Washington, D.C. And I'm like, I'm not going to miss that. And so for the next 2 months, I started speaking at our chapel. I started talking with the administration and getting people, you know, and educating people about it. I convinced the school to give me money for a charter bus. I convinced one of my academic specialists to get a van from their church. I had over 200 and something signatures, awesome, people that wanted to go. Wound up only having 22. I think maybe 18 of them were females. Who wound up going. Many of them were members of Delta Sigma Theta, the Beta Epsilon chapter at Virginia Union University. But we had an awesome experience, but that's one of the things that kind of prompted me into doing that. So then I started getting involved in student government and getting involved in judicial affairs and,
right,
and how in ethics. That what kind of propelled me. And then I traveled the country as on a political action committee. And as I engaged with constituents from Ohio to Pennsylvania to Virginia to New Jersey to North Carolina and Florida, a lot of people just don't know information. And so it was like, okay, well, what can I do to strengthen them? Because the strength of our democracy is in our people and the knowledge that we have. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people, they didn't have it, or didn't have somebody who was patient enough to sit down with them to break it down. And so as a presenter, an educator, a trainer, that's what I want to be able to do. Ultimately, one day I want to run for Congress, but I think that I will be inefficient if my people aren't my strength. You know, I shouldn't be the strongest person. My job is to go and vote,
right,
and have and have the courage to do that.
Okay.
I think it's up to you as a constituents to put the things together, but I'm going to teach people how to do that before I ever run for office.
Absolutely. Right.
If I ever
run. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now that dovetails well with your role on the, as a panelist on the Walt Weekly, because I don't know whether you had a chance to look at the mission statement. I know you have, but, you know, we want to teach people, you know, and we want to break it down in such a way that it's understandable, or if they missed it, because a lot of people apparently get their news from social media, which is right. It can augment, you know, the news. But I think you got to go to various sources, because, you know, one thing I always go back to is critical thinking. And I think you mentioned that. And critical thinking, you try to understand what's an opinion versus a fact. Okay, that's critical thinking.
Right.
So right. With that said, what are some of the key issues that are near and dear or on your front burner? I know you mentioned that you want to run for Congress and you want to be an educator. Are there any other major issues or, you know, something that you didn't mention that are near and dear to your heart?
I mean, a couple of things are some of the social economical issues that are happening within our communities. I think part of that can be solved through the reparations that we kind of briefly touched on. Those gaps have been there for so long that it's going to take a considerable amount of time and effort to being able to really correct them. We're talking about generations of individuals who have been in quote unquote projects,
right?
Welfare systems, we can go see Black students now and still get half of the class that are first time college attendees or potential graduates. So to be 13% of the U.S. population, but still be 50% of first time college attendees, even after all the online institutions that are out there, you still can get half of the class who are like, yeah, this is my first time. Nobody in my immediate family. Now, there may be some extended family, but nobody in my immediate family has ever been to college.
Right.
Right. And so those things are near and dear to me. Generational wealth is a part of that. Being able to create it, being able to be self-sufficient, and not in no way suggesting that we're going to be separatist or
that's the first thing that I thought about.
Nothing to that, but it's one of those things, like, you know, can't, you know, how can you sustain your own within your own community?
Right.
You know, the value of a dollar, the value of a word, of a story, being able to cherish and share our stories, you know, control our narrative. I mean, I think those are some things that do, wealth, education.
That should tie in with reparations.
Yeah.
With reparations, it should be generational wealth. It should be education with reparations. We need to be taught in our community how to control our finances. You know, we need education. That should be number one.
Yes.
We need land, property, you know, and reparations. Yes. I just feel like it should not just be a monetary thing.
Definitely. Right. Absolutely. And I think that having those in place will quell a lot of the violence that is there, because you can remove the need for it. But that in itself, I think, is such a convoluted, complex issue as it pertains to why violence exists, you know.
Right. Poverty
and drugs, mm-hmm. and you're in poverty, and those things. And so there's a lot of that we can get into. We can definitely get into the weeds of all those different things. I'll rephrase that. We can get into the trenches.
Yeah. Yeah.
when discussing some of those things. Mm-hmm. But those are some issues that I think that over time. that if we, you know, if, you know, the belief of each one teach one, and in having the love, affection, and patience for one another.
Definitely.
I think we can definitely solve a lot of those. A lot of those.
Definitely. Takes a village.
There you go. Yeah.
But we have to rebuild the village.
Yeah, oh, we definitely do.
You know, villages like I had, that's for sure.
Ernest. Sergeant, I appreciate you coming on and sharing these thoughts with us and your history. And yeah, you know, only thing I can say is that, you know, I'm very proud of you, what you've done, you know, and where you're going.
Definitely.
All right. And, you know, I'm glad you're part of the Walt Weekly podcast. I just have to shout that out, you know, because when it gets on, you know, on those legal things and laws and things of that nature, you're the man, you know.
Right. Very knowledgeable.
Yeah, you're extremely knowledgeable. And I'm proud of you because you're the same age as my son. Just like I tell my son, I'm proud of him. I'm proud of you. My son's friends, right. You know, he's a colonel in the Marines. You know, I tell him the same thing. They all are the same age as you. So, you know, with that, I just want to thank you for what you do, what you bring to the table. And I want to thank you also for taking the time to do this interview with Michelle and I. And, yes. You know, it's about time.